Hello and welcome into this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Well, folks, it is time for the 90th Masters. Rex and I have been on site at Augusta National for the past couple of days. There's been a lot to get to. We had basically the Super Bowl media day of all press conferences on Tuesday. We had Masters Chairman Fred Ridley address reporters on Wednesday. Golf course conditions, firm and fast. Please, for the love of God, do not play a drinking game with the words firm and fast during the broadcast. It is going to be mentioned innumerable times over the next couple of days. But Rex, you've been out here talking to players, talking to caddies, talking to agents, talking to equipment reps. What has sort of struck your fancy at this point?
That would be the best drinking game ever. Firm and fast. You're going to get wore out real quick. I wouldn't suggest doing it for 4 days. Maybe just save that for Sunday. I think the conditions are at the top of the list. I don't think you could come up with a better forecast than what we've seen. And I've been the one that's standing in the first fairway every morning. I've been struggling to find different ways of saying that, yes, it's absolutely perfect. I now feel like what it must feel like to be a weatherman in San Diego. It's sunny and 70. Isn't it great, everybody outside? But, I mean, it is going to be challenging. And I think one of the punch shot questions that Fred sent down the line was winning score has been between 10, 12, 13 under par, I think, about the last 5 years. And that seems about right because we can sit here and break it down. And it looks like Thursday is going to be the toughest day, at least weather-wise. There's going to be a little bit of wind. It's going to be cool when guys tee up. It's going to get but warm over the course of the weekend. I'm on the low side of that. I think it's going to be somewhere around 10 under par. I don't know that the guys are going to go completely crazy, only because this is perfect. When you have the mad scientists that Augusta National does, and they can do whatever it is they want to the golf course, as long as Mother Nature doesn't intervene, that they can turn this into the type of experiment that I think everybody wants to see, which is, again, drink up firm and fast. And you did a really good job on the show earlier today about trying to quantify exactly what that means. It means essentially instead of having a 3-yard area to land an approach shot, you have a 1-yard area. On an exacting course, it only makes it more exacting.
Yeah, your favorite ball striker is going to be leading this golf tournament, most likely at every single stage
of the
tournament. And apologies to producer Fred. He did have the punch out of winning score. He also had a question. Will the Masters record score of 62? So 63 is the record. Will we finally see a Masters record score of 62 be broached?
Nope.
I scoffed at it, completely dismissed it. Last year, keep in mind, Justin Rose shot 65.
Was that your written response?
Yes, I absolutely poo-pooed the idea. I don't even think we're going to get remotely close. Again, Justin Rose shot 65 a year ago in the opening round. 65-66 would be a phenomenal score under these conditions. Again, you mentioned firm and fast. Yes. Gulp, what that's really going to bring out and place a premium on, Rex, is distance control with approach shots. It's certainly going to re-emphasize lag putting, which is always essential at Augusta National, particularly when the greens are going to be getting the speeds that they will get over the duration of the tournament. And also scrambling, because if everyone is missing greens because all of a sudden they're really hard to hold, which player can get up and down with the most frequency? So you see a player, typically the Masters champion, somewhere around that 70% up and down range for scrambling. Expect to see that again so far this week. And so why has this happened? Well, the ideal growing conditions over the past couple of days certainly aid in that. We had basically just a sprinkling on Saturday and Sunday, nothing to really quench the golf course. As you mentioned, flawless weather these first couple of days leading into the tournament. And on Wednesday, it was actually pretty cold this morning. I was up on the set with Paige McKenzie, Aaron
Holzer. Was it cold on the set?
It must have been so chilly. Yes, the wind was really blowing behind us. Actually, so much so, this is a little bit inside TV. You may have noticed, if you're watching for 3 hours, and if you did, God help you, we had one segment where we were indoors. That was because a column on the set toppled over. The wind was so strong, about 25 miles an hour. Had I been seated in that position, Rex, my brain would have been crushed. I would have received a $50 million settlement, no doubt about it. Instead,
you would not have. Your family would have.
Yes, we came in safely. It has been fastened. It is not going to happen again for the duration of the week. But yes, it was cool. It was windy. The forecast for the next couple of days, warm and sunny. Next couple of days, about 20 mile an hour gusts on Thursday, the exact same wind direction that we saw on Wednesday. Why is that important? Because we saw Scottie Scheffler, Rory McIlroy, Jordan Spieth, Kyle Morikawa, Cam Young, Brooks Koepka, all of the heavy hitters, all the players that we were expecting to factor in this golf tournament, they were out on the range session of the tournament practice area 8 or 9 a.m., trying to get a feel for that wind, going off on the second nine and understanding exactly how those holes on the second nine in particular are going to be playing in this wind.
And I was fascinated by that because the wind we have seen really since we've been here, I've been here since Sunday, you've been here since Saturday, has been east-northeast. And it's been relatively light. Today is by far the windiest of all days. I think 25 mile an hour gust today, which is going to make the par three contest a little difficult for those.
A lot of aces so far.
I was a little surprised by that. A lot of WDs as well. I was noticing.
A lot of Jason Kelce as well.
Yes, a lot of Jason Kelce. But if you track it forward, it's going to be about the same on Thursday and Friday, at least from the same direction. The wind's going to come down a little bit. But then on the weekend, it's going to flip out of the southeast. And I was talking with a caddy this morning that for a player like a John Rahm, who's playing his 10th Masters, or Tommy Fleetwood, his 10th Masters, or certainly Scottie Scheffler, players who've been here and done that, that they can make that adjustment pretty quickly. But the example this caddy gave me is imagine playing your first Masters. Ben Griffin, for example, and playing holes 11 and 12 downwind the first 2 days and then showing up Saturday and suddenly they're into the wind. Even if it's just 10, 15 miles an hour, it's still going to make a difference. So you're going to have to stay on your toes. It still will be demanding on top of everything we said about drink up now, firm and fast. And I do want to say you abandoned your seat after your shift. I had to go back for a couple of other hits. And while I was in there, they actually bolted that big board essentially into the wall, and the funny joke was they need to protect the national treasures that will be in there coming in the next couple of days. We're talking about Jack Nicklaus, Ben Crenshaw, Tom Watson. Oh. They weren't necessarily worried about Rex Harding and Ryan Lavner. I can guarantee you that.
Nor should they have been. To your point, Rex, there's a reason why no Masters rookie has won this tournament since 1979. There's so much institutional knowledge, so many different wind directions that you need to be factoring in. And again, if you're a first timer, you would not necessarily have seen that. Let's get into the chairman, Masters Chairman Fred Ridley, his State of the Masters address, which was on Wednesday. That was actually during my shift change. I was not in the room. It seemed, at least on the outset, Rex, that there was not going to be sort of the existential questions that had threatened the game that we'd seen over the past couple of years. And was the chairman of Augusta National and the Masters going to render a verdict on what sort of has divided and fractured the golf landscape? What was your biggest takeaway from what the chairman had to say?
We kind of talked about this earlier on Live From, and I think he stuck to the script that you and I sort of predicted that first and foremost, it was the rollback, the golf ball. I think the chairman, Augusta National itself, has been pretty forceful about the idea that they think it's time for a rollback. In this place, it is a fascinating conversation when it comes to Augusta National, because no other golf course in the world can keep up with the improved physics, the improved health, the improved technology, everything that allows the modern professional player to hit it 3 million yards. If anywhere can keep up with it, it's here. They have the money, they have all the land they could possibly want, and they have the will to do so. And so for this club, of all clubs, to stand up and say, enough is enough. We have to do something to stop this incredible march towards longer and longer drives. I think it always sends a good statement. It seems right now all the sides are at a bit of a stalemate, where it seems as if the USGA and the RNA are contemplating maybe putting a pause on the rollback. Maybe all the pressure they're feeling is making them think twice about maybe 2030 is not the right year. Maybe we kick the can down.
It's 2028 for the professionals.
2028 for the professionals.
We're a year and a half away from potentially
you and I and everyone else in the world. I think this was a statement. I mean, if you were going to pick apart anything the chairman said today, that was a statement that it is time. And I think he says it is inevitable. This is something you have to do. The change isn't easy, but this is change that has to happen.
I mean, he's not even doubling down at this point with Fred Ridley. He's tripling and quadrupling down. Yeah. He is adamant that this is the best path forward. It does seem to be setting up a game of chicken, and who's going to be blinking first? Is it going to be the governing bodies and sort of bending to the knee of PGA Tour players or equipment manufacturers who don't want to see this?
Or the PGA of America.
Or the PGA of America as well. Will they eventually just push it back to 2030, keeping it in line with the recreational player like you and I? Again, the difference of which with a different golf ball is reportedly going to be negligible, according to the governing bodies. And look, Augusta National has all the resources that they possibly can. You saw in 2024.
Your shank won't go nearly as far.
Trust me, it'll go just as far offline. We've seen some of the holes that have been lengthened, 13th and 15th. I think both of those changes have been pretty well received over the past couple of years, just offering a little bit of unpredictability, making those holes, restoring the shot value. That is what Fred Ridley, who again was the last U.S. amateur champion who decided not to turn professional. He has a great background in this. He understands the amateur game. He understands the recreational game. He understands what it takes to play at the top level as well. He understands the shot values and trying to restore that. He called the game currently one-dimensional, speaking, I think, predominantly about what happens week in and week out on the PGA Tour. That doesn't necessarily happen here at Augusta National. Again, they have the land, they have the resources, they have the opportunity to expand holes if needed. He's talking about the greater good of the game, the game at large. Not every golf course is going to have these resources. Not every golf course will avoid being brought to their knees by distance.
And I was also taken by turning the page a little bit. And you're right. We didn't have the big live golf conversation. There wasn't really questions about the fractured game and what does that mean for Augusta National. But there was one telling moment. He kind of talked about his relationship with Brian Rolette, the CEO of the PGA Tour. And he talked about Brian Rolette made a trip up here not that long ago to sort of meet and to sit and talk about and what he envisioned. I think that sent a good message that he wants to be, both sides want to be collaborative. And I think that's the word that the chairman used. But there was one interesting response where the chairman was asked about something that Rolab said at the Players' Championship that went along the lines, we all know that the PGA Tour does not control any of the four majors or the Ryder Cup. And I think Rolab's comment about that was, it doesn't seem exactly right when you consider that these events are made, they're financially viable because essentially the PGA Tour's labor, largely the PGA Tour's labor. And I was taken by the chairman's response to that was, it's an ecosystem. Because he would argue that if you look at the success of the PGA Tour, there's a lot of lower level, there's a lot of grassroots players. He pointed out that a lot of players in this week's field, maybe the majority of players, played on the AJGA. The majority of players probably played in college. So you have a lot of constituencies that he was pointing out that it's just not the PGA Tour. I think that was a message.
Fascinating game of chess between those two, potentially those power brokers. I think regardless of what happens, the Masters would be above the fray and above the fold on that situation. All right, that's 11 minutes of preamble with sort of the newsy stuff off the golf course. How about, Rex, some players to watch? Again, Tuesday was sort of the big press conference day. You had the Scotties, you had the Rorys, you had the Brysons heading into the press building here at Augusta National. Which of those players do you think gave you a better sense of where they are with the year's first major on the horizon?
Last week, you and I did our top 10 list. I'm going to reference back to that for about the millionth time. However, I'm going to flip my list. I've been convinced.
Just like the inverse of it.
Not the inverse, just kind of the top three. I'm going to rearrange it because it was some combination of Scottie Scheffler I had first on my list. I think I had Bryson DeChambeau second and John Rahm third. I am flipping it in the sense that John Rahm is now first on my list. Based on what I heard, based on what I've seen, based on what people have told me, this is not a completely uneducated pick. I would also say I probably would want to put Xander Schauffele a little bit higher on my list right now. That's not to say I'm going to dismiss Scottie Scheffler. He's still inside my top three. I'm not going to dismiss Bryson DeChambeau. What you're looking at here is who's giving me enough reason, who's giving me any reason to move them down the list, because John Rahm hasn't given me any reasons. I mean, you can point to his recent history at the Masters as maybe a reason. I would argue that I think we have enough in the books now to say LIV Golf's move to 72 holes not only has changed the dynamic on that tour, and you've seen the cream now rise to the top. John Rahm has won, hasn't finished outside the top five. Bryson DeChambeau has won twice. Someone on LIV Golf pointed out today that if they went to 96 holes, Bryson and John Rahm would probably win every single event. It was Tiger Woods' line always throughout my career. Give me the most holes, eventually my talent.
I'm not sure why they played 96, but we can.
But whatever the number is, I think I'm just throwing it out.
I think the same thing with Scottie Scheffler on the PGA Tour. The more holes
you play,
the better players.
To be fair.
Why John Rahm specifically do you feel so good about this week?
I had a chance to interview him. I have had a chance to watch him. I talked with a player who plays a lot with him. And Scottsdale, Robert Garrigues, who told me that if you didn't pick John Rahm to win the Masters, then you probably haven't been paying attention. He said he hasn't missed a shot back home in Scottsdale. I asked John Rahm that, and he was pretty dismissive, like, No PGA Tour pro misses a shot at home. And I'm like, whoa.
That's not true. That's not true whatsoever.
That's not true at all. And I just think the preparation is better. 72 holes identify the champion better. But I think in John Rahm's case, it's allowed him to come in here with a clearer mind. I think he's lighter of foot, how our friends in the UK would say it. I think there's a confidence that maybe has been missing there. And I think maybe he has something to prove. That, look, they all crave the spotlight, even the one Scottie Scheffler that says he doesn't. He wants to crave the spotlight in the sense that I want to be the guy at the end of the week that's getting putting his arm into that jacket.
Yeah, John Rahm is an alpha. John Rahm will go down as one of the best European players ever. It does seem interesting, though, Rex, that this is now the third straight year that there's been at least a little bit of controversy surrounding John Rahm. You think back a couple years ago, this was the first time he played a major championship since he jumped to LIV just last year. His form, remember, in the major championships in 2024 had really fallen off. And everyone's like, oh, is John Rahm all of a sudden a worse player now that he's playing 54-hole events in shorts? He did not have a great Masters again in 2025. This year, and John Rahm addressed it on Tuesday, is sort of the lingering cloud over his head with his Ryder Cup eligibility. And keep in mind, he rejected an offer from the DP World Tour that would have allowed him access to some tournaments and thus remaining eligible on the Ryder Cup. If you missed it, John Rahm essentially said, we are negotiating. We're continuing negotiating. And he is expecting some sort of compromise and some sort of deal to be reached before the events that he's planning to play in September. He did not elaborate what he would be willing to compromise. And it doesn't seem, if you're the DP World Tour, why you would have any incentive to do so either, considering you just struck a deal with eight other players, that those and those players found those conditions to be quite amenable.
I get what you're saying, and you're absolutely right. It seems like there's always something over John Rahm's head, some sort of subtext story that we always get into. In this particular case, it's so far down the road. And I think that was his point in his press conference, saying that I don't know if I'm suspended right now from the DP World Tour. It doesn't matter, because the next event I'd want to play is in September. I believe it's the Irish Open. So it's not as though it's something that's in the back of his mind right now. Now, to your point, and I think Rory McIlroy probably said this best, what else does he want the DP World Tour to do? I would argue eight players were offered this deal. Seven took it. There's a reason why those seven players thought this was a good deal. For whatever reason, John does not. And I'm not quite sure why he thinks the European Tour is going to cave on this.
But I think from a leverage standpoint, if you're John Rahm and you win the Masters, all of a sudden it could be a different conversation. If you're the European Tour, do you really look at what would then be a reigning Masters champion? Could you really stomach the idea of not having him on that team? It would certainly be a good bargaining chip, if nothing else.
But I don't think it's that. I don't think that's the conversation. I don't think the conversation is about, well, John Rahm, the Masters champion versus not the Masters champion, because he already has a green jacket. He has a U.S. Open. He's already
the
a
current major Masters champion.
I get what you're saying. I think this is a bigger conversation about next year's Ryder Cup. And I will also go back to the idea that in John Rahm's mind, do you really think this team's going to collapse, fall apart? You think somehow Luke Donald's going to lose his magic?
They're still going to win even without John.
They're still going to be heavily favored with or without John Rahm. So I think right now he's playing the game of chicken, and the DP World Tour is more than willing to sit and wait this out.
Yeah, I think it's more of a perception than actually the reality of not having him on the team. Just the perception of not having the reigning Masters champion on the European Ryder Cup team might be a little bit too much to stomach. It is interesting, though, Rex. We were having the conversation about John Rahm, and I, too, really like John Rahm. I would firmly put him, if not among the top favorites, at least the top two or three this week. And I sort of looked at the stats that John Rahm has produced so far on LIV Golf this season. From a greens and regulation standpoint, he's hitting 82% of the greens. The strokes gains are nuts. He is the statistically the best player in 2026 so far. So he's 82% greens regulations. Rex, scrambling, he's like 75%. Putting that in context, that is so far above what the PGA Tour leader in greens of regulation is doing by about 7 or 8 percentage points. And it would put him in line with a Hideki Matsuyama, who's leading the PGA Tour in scrambling. Aaron Oberholzer, love him. He was quick to jump down my throat and said, look, this is merely a product of the golf courses that John Rahm is playing. And to that point, he's absolutely correct. They've played 5 live events so far this season. 4 of those events have been won with a winning score of 23 par, under par, or lower.
Maybe.
So look, they're easier tracks, and he's taking advantage. Better iron players. If you're hitting more greens, the spots that you do miss are easier to get up and down from. I totally understand that. Statistically, though, it is indisputable he has been the best player in 2026, and this is a great opportunity for him.
Maybe that's what makes this such a good week, though. This is going to be such a good litmus test, just not for John Rahm, for Bryson DeChambeau, for Patrick Reed. I think there's plenty of players that have some questions they need to answer. Scottie Scheffler, to be fair.
Yeah.
I mean, he hasn't exactly been lighting up the world. He hasn't been the world number one the last couple of weeks. Here's a place for him to prove it.
Interesting. You bring up Scottie Scheffler, and there was a lot to get into with Scottie, the golf course, the birth of his second son about a week and a half ago. At this point, one thing that he really did not touch on was the state of his game. And I don't know if that was by design. I don't know if that was intentional. He merely said that his game was in a, quote, good spot. And when our buddy Will Gray asked him, how would you compare your form heading into the 2026
he
Masters,
like
say heading into 2022 when you won, or say heading into 2024 when you won, he basically dismissed it and said that would require too much work for me to think about. I don't want to think right now, and completely poo-pooed it. So we don't really have a great answer of what he and Randy Smith were working on over the past 3 weeks. We did have Randy Smith, his swing coach, on Golf Today. They essentially said that they were trying to clean up, trying to come to an understanding of why Scottie had some of the misses that he did, particularly, I think, off the tee, Rex. Scottie Scheffler was missing right off the tee at a higher rate than at any point in his career. So you look at his driving accuracy is down. He's missing wider. His proximity to the hole is well outside the top 100 on the PGA Tour, which is shocking to see as well. How much faith do you have in Scottie that those 3 weeks were able to clean up the issues that he had and now he can potentially win a third green jacket in 5 years?
And I was a little shocked. I was looking at Data Golf this morning, and at Bay Hill, he actually lost strokes to the field in strokes gained approach. And I don't know the last time he did that.
Back-to-back weeks, Riv 2.
I mean, it's pretty shocking to me because those are his hallmarks. That's just not an off week. That's the thing he does best, and everything else falls into line, and he wins by five shots. I think everyone has been watching Scottie Scheffler's movements around property this week. When he goes to the range, what is he doing with Randy Smith? It's kind of tough to suss out exactly how that's going because it always looks like there's confusion. He's always staring at his grip like he's grabbing the club for the first time, famously. I mean, he always looks like he's trying to start from zero to get back to 100. And we know that's not the case. And I think the point that you and I talked about last week, we know he loves everything in his boxes. He wants to show up at big events completely prepared. He wants no question marks. The question will be to me, is everything that's transpired over the last few weeks, his substandard play, specifically during the Florida swing, and the birth of his second child, a distraction, a great distraction, but a distraction nonetheless. Is he showing?
Would you say demands the other day?
Yeah, demands.
He has more demands.
I got an earful about that one.
Sure, yes. I'm sure you did.
Is he going to arrive here prepared? Because I think mentally, that's what separates him from everyone else. He has no doubt when he shows at an event prepared because he knows he's checked all those boxes. The question will be, has he done it this time?
Yeah, I'm very curious to see that as well. The iron play is going to be of paramount importance. Yeah. Just because Scottie Scheffler is one of the few players in the field when you have the hook lies, and again, on the par fours and fives, they are predominantly hook lies for a right hand with the ball above your feet. He hits those shots and the high fades coming off a hook lie better than anyone in the field. That is the reason why he has won two Masters titles in the past 4 years.
Brando did a breakdown of Bryson last night on that very idea, and I would suggest anybody go to YouTube because it was so enlightening. You don't realize how many hook lies you get here. Almost every lie from the fairway is a hook lie. And he pointed out, like in very good detail, that Bryson's swing path, at least last year at this time, was so far out to the right. And there's no way.
He still hits an into out swing.
I'm not quite sure it's those numbers if you're going to look at it like degree wise. However, it's still out to the right. But last year it was insane. And there was just no way for him to control the ball. But by comparison, you're right. Scottie has very good club face control.
Very good club face control. Hits towering high fades into those greens. Bryson, meanwhile, hits sort of hard going draws. And again, with firm and fast conditions, that could be a potential issue for Bryson DeChambeau. This is a long way, Rex, of getting to our defending champion, Rory McIlroy, who's had a busy week. We saw him on Saturday at the Augusta National Women's Amateur, congratulating some of the competitors there. We saw him handing out trophies at the Drive, Chip, and Putt on Sunday. He played 18 holes with his father, Jerry, soaking in all the accolades as the reigning Masters winner. And of course, he had the extravagant dinner on Tuesday for the first time, the Champions Dinner, without Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson in contention. I think in attendance. I think the big question as it relates to Rory is, does all of the unburdening that happened by him winning on the 18th green and convulsing and having a decade plus of tournament torment exercise from Rory McIlroy's body, does that now free him up? Or do you think he plays his best golf when he actually has something to chase? I think that's the question that we're going to have at least somewhat answered by Sunday.
Par three with Poppy. Don't forget that as well.
That's right.
That's pretty cool as well. And according to our Todd Lewis, $50,000 wine bill during that dinner on Tuesday. That seems low.
Damon Hacker, our pal, was salivating when he was reading through the wine.
I am not a wino, but I've been told by all my wino friends that was quite the list. The after dinner drink he referred to as liquid gold.
Sure.
Yeah, that has to be pretty good. I think the unburdening, as you put it, is liberating, and we have seen that. It was one of his best press conferences.
Oh, and he's phenomenal.
He's had so many good ones out the course of his career. But it was, and there was one moment when he was sort of asked along these lines that, look, I still show up here wanting to win. I'm still doing all of the things that I would normally do. But does this year feel different?
Absolutely.
I go to a different locker room. I park in a different parking lot, and I dress differently. Like everything about this week.
Just the ease, the relaxation, not having that burden. He said that he would always dread coming to Augusta National. Wait for Thursday to get started. Now he said, I don't care if Thursday never comes because it's just such a a pleasant feeling. He said he described it to walking on a cloud here at Augusta National. It's just a completely different vibe.
And he's such an emotionally driven player. You see him play his best in emotional spots, the Ryder Cup, the major championships, here trying to win the career Grand Slam. He feeds off of that. But this week, I think that emotion, there's always the element of, is it going to backfire? Are you going to start walking up 18 on Thursday and instead of focusing on your shot, think about what it felt like to climb that hill and to cry ugly like he did and all of the things that he went through? I think it's going to be a struggle for him. And he alluded to that in the press conference. That'll be it for him. I think beyond his game, and we spent a lot of time talking where Scottie Scheffler's game is, I don't know that Rory McIlroy's game is at 100 either. I think he's dealing with little pieces of his game that just aren't quite where he wants it to be. But beyond that, you're dealing with the emotional toll. And make no doubt about it, there was an emotional toll of being here this week. It's great. It's clear he has enjoyed every single moment of it, but it's still exhausting until you can mask it with adrenaline for only so long.
Yeah. If I'm going to be honest, I don't have a good read on what we're going to see from Rory. I could easily see him finishing 25th and sort of shrugging afterward, like, I had my moment in the sun last year, and that's
see you next year and forever.
Yeah, I'm perfectly fine with that, and I'll see you guys in a couple of weeks, probably playing Quail Hollow ahead of the PGA Championship. I could definitely see it going that way. I could also see him, Rex, wanting to double down and try to become the first player since Tiger Woods in 01, 02 to successfully defend his Masters title. You mentioned the game that might be a little bit off, and I think we would all have a clear way to analyze him had he played a couple weeks ago in Houston. Instead, he hasn't played since the Players' Championship. When you look at strictly PGA Tour rounds, last year heading into the Masters, he played 20 PGA Tour rounds. This year, he has played 14. Four of those were compromised. Two of those came before WD. You look at the putting, which is sort of the aspect of his game, which statistically has fallen off. I think even that sort of deserves an asterisk. He never putts particularly well at Pebble Beach. He never putts particularly well at Riviera.
Okay.
Both of those are skewing his statistics, particularly from the 4 to 8 foot range. Look at what happened at the Players' Championship in his last start. He was questionable to even tee it up.
He's 100% healthy, though. Brad Faxon talked about it on the show this afternoon. He's close with him. He's 100%.
He is. So I think there's a lot of disclaimers with his putting in particular, which again is the part of his game which has fallen off. I think, though, from a ball striking standpoint, his iron play is much sharper than it was a year ago. And for all we're talking about, the firm and fast conditions that we're going to be having here at Augusta National.
Like a drunk's watching this podcast.
That is going to be very, very helpful. Again, he put the spin your ball into play with the wind picking up on Thursday, needing to hold it on the greens. I think that aspect at least gives me a little bit of confidence. All right. Give me some contenders, Rex. Not the guy you think is going to win. I think you already said it's going to be John Rahm. Mm-hmm. How about some other players that you would expect to play well and maybe vie for the title and try to slip into a green jacket?
Cameron Young. Mm-hmm. I think it's almost inevitable in my mind at this point. And it's not just based on what he did at the Players' Championship, but I don't think you can ever
Nice record here. Two top tens.
He has a good record here. I think everything he has done this year, he made it clear after the win at TPC Sawgrass that everything he's done this year has been geared towards this week. To a certain degree, I think what happened at the Players was just a happy byproduct of what he was trying to do coming into the season, because this is when he wanted to play his best golf. And I don't see any reason why he's not there. There's no injuries. There's no fall off. There's no reason why he can't use that momentum. We've seen it time and time again. JJ Spahn is a great example of what he was able to do, take that momentum from the Players and end up winning the U.S. Open later in the year. And you just look at what he does. He hits the ball a mile high. He controls his irons, especially his wedges, really well. And he can draw the ball. We talk about this all the time, especially in firm and fast conditions. If I had the ability to go stand behind the second tee for the entire first round, I would, because there's magically a new tree that's growing up that is really going to make the Players move the ball. Not quite as much as maybe what you'll see on the 10th hole, but it's what they want you to do on this golf course. They're forcing you to hit a shot. It goes back to what Fred Redley said. They don't want to see people just stand on tees and launch it as far as they can. You have to hit golf shots, and he could do that.
He certainly can do that. Favors a drawing of the golf ball as well. I'm tempted to say that this is a wide-open Masters, Rex, but I don't really believe it, because the Masters is still the most predictable.
I think you did it. How many people do you think can win? I think you said it this morning.
Yeah, typically, if we're being honest, it's like 6 to 8 players. I think you're probably somewhere in the 12 to 15 player range, which, again, it feels fun. It feels fresh. It's sort of the byproduct, I think, of Rory and Scotty being not beyond their game that we've seen over the past couple of years. I asked you on Sunday, sort of stumped you Rex, of who would you call right now as we sit here on April 8th, the PGA Tour Player of the Year? You didn't have a very good answer.
I don't even think you had an answer. I don't think I had an answer.
Could it be Chris Goddrop, who's won twice?
Goddrop is the one that should have come to mind.
Could it be Matt Fitzpatrick, who won the Valspar and finished runner-up at the Players' Championship? Would it be Cameron Young, who's, again, played well in signature events and won the PGA Tour's flagship event as well? And so there's not anyone who has been a dominant player heading into the Masters. And so to that point, I could see a number of outcomes that would not surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me at all to see Cameron Young slip into a green jacket. It would not surprise me at all if Matt Fitzpatrick, who does not have a great record here at Augusta National, gets it done. It wouldn't surprise me if Patrick Reed, who has played very well in the DP World Tour, gets a second green jacket. I could see Xander Schauffele. I could see Ludvig Åberg, who has played, I think, as consistently well, maybe outside of Cameron Young, over the past month, three consecutive top five finishes. Can he get across the line at a golf course at Augusta National? He has played well each of the past 2 years. And so, yeah, I think from where we were a number of years ago, 6 to 8, and you're probably skewing towards Scotty anyway, I think now 12 to 15 players, which I think makes this 90th Masters much more compelling to watch.
And I'm not trying to be rude here. I went to our friends at DraftKings and just started looking at the outrights.
Tommy Fleetwood as well is a good call.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some interesting names on here. I wanted to go 15 deep and see how I felt about that because I think Brooks Koepka, I think you were writing something this afternoon.
I would put
Brooks Koepka in the newsletter, which is the time you would plug the newsletter.
Yes, we do have a newsletter coming out. Make sure you are signing up. I'll drop a link to the sign up here in the YouTube comment section as well, but that's going to be hitting inboxes on Thursday morning.
And I think Patrick Reed, Jordan Spieth, Goddrop, Victor Hovland, right around that area is about 15, where you start cutting it off. And I think me saying those names probably makes you think to yourself that maybe not 15. Because when you, yeah.
I mean, I would put Patrick Reed in that category. Jordan Spieth would be an outlier for me. He has not put it all together on this golf course. He potentially could. Victor Hovland, as good as his iron play is, do you really trust him around the greens if it's going to get potentially dicey and tricky, as we've talked about with those firm and fast conditions? I would put Brooks Koepka, though, in that category, a player who could win here.
I would as well. I think this one came up after I mentioned it, Akshay Bhatia, and for a lot of different
reasons. Akshay is the only player on the PGA Tour who's top 10 in putting and in approach play this season. So, yeah, it would not surprise me as well.
We have seen time and time again how this golf course favors a left-hander because just the physics of it. If you can make a high fade as a left-hander, hit much more gently.
Hideki Matsuyama, I'd throw in that.
Oh, sure.
As well.
And I think you're right. I think it's a little bit deeper field than we're giving credit for, but inevitably I think we're going to end up to Sunday and it's going to come down to four or five guys simply because of how demanding the conditions are going to be. And to your point, I think you started the podcast with, it's going to be a ball striker's delight. If you cannot hit it where you're looking, which I think you start going through the list and that gets narrow really quick, especially when you're talking about the most elite ball strikers, you're not going to have any success on this golf course.
Augusta National plays its best when it is at its most exacting, when there is a steep penalty to be paid for a shot that is mishit or a portion of the green that is not found, potentially in a three putt. Maybe it rolls off into a collection area that makes it difficult up and down. Obviously, with all the false fronts, you're potentially running into some water and some big numbers that way. But also, Rex, the payoff for a well-struck shot can be immense when the conditions are exacting because there is such a reward finding that shelf, finding that tier, and giving yourself a good birdie look. Again, this is not a golf tournament where guys are typically pouring in 20, 25 footers. You're either hitting it close or you're avoiding big numbers. I think it's going to be that sort of Masters.
Taking advantage of the par fives.
10 under par, yeah. 68, 69 are good scores. Add up at the end of the week and see where you fall. Any final thoughts before we get out of here?
It's the other cliche, and this could become a drinking game as well, but no course changes more from, let's say, Wednesday through Sunday. But John Rahm had a savvy short game. You look at statistically, anybody who misses more than 50% of their greens has zero chance. I mean, I think that's been proven historically and statistically. But John Rahm had a great anecdote about the idea of how it changes. He said on Tuesday, he missed the green on 11. And he goes, and he's kind of at the bottom of the hill. And he goes, I walked up, and it's the easiest chip in the world. It's kind of a bit of a fluffy lie. You can spin it. You can throw it in the air. It was so easy to execute this shot. And he turned to whoever he was playing with, and he said, by Sunday, that shot's going to be impossible. I'm not going to be able to keep it on the green. That's a great example of what to expect.
It's going to be a lot of fun to watch. And again, we've got a lot of content up for you. It's not just on golfchannel.com, but we also have a Rex in Lav newsletter that's going to be dropping through Golf Channel three times over the next couple of days. Is going to be an edition that I just wrote on Wednesday, going in inboxes on Thursday. We're going to have a midway edition writing on Friday in your inboxes on Saturday. And of course, we will have the final wrap-up which will be in your inboxes on Monday. We'll also have mini pods. This is a longer edition because this is the official preview edition, but we'll have 15 to 20 minutes after each and every tournament round. And of course, the made for TV 52 minute edition on Sunday night. We'll be recording it from Augusta National. It's going to be a lot of fun. Got a lot of coverage for you. Thanks as always for listening. Thanks as always for watching. Rex and I will be back on live from the Masters on Golf Channel beginning at 8 a.m. Eastern time on Thursday. You can catch us there. Thanks for listening. Thanks for support. Enjoy the first round of the 90th Masters.